would lead the frontal assault using a tanker truck equipped with a plow. A pair of trucks full of men would follow. A pickup at the rear, armed with a .50 caliber and a grenade launcher, would dispense with the towers if need be. Michael's orders were to avoid casualties if possible. But if it came to that... The teams dispersed at a quick step. Michael and his men took up positions around the barracks, a long Quonset hut with doors front and rear. They were expecting 50 well-armed men inside, perhaps more. Team 1, good to go. Team 2, roger that. Michael checked his watch. 0450. He looked at Patch, who nodded. Michael raised his flare gun and fired. A popping flash and the compound appeared around them in blocks of light and shadow. A second later, Patch launched the gas canister from its tube. Shouts and gunfire from the gate, and then a crash as the semi plowed through the fence. Gas had begun to sift under the door of the barracks. As it flew open, Michael's men released a barrage of grazing fire into the dirt. The fleeing soldiers lurched backward in confusion. More men were careening into them from behind, choking and coughing and sputtering. "On your knees! Drop your weapons! Hands on your heads!" The soldiers had nowhere to run. On to their knees they went. "Everyone report. Team 2, secure. Lucius? No casualties. Headed your way. Team 1. Michael's men had moved forward to wrap the soldiers' wrists and ankles with heavy cord. Most were still coughing, a few vomiting helplessly. "Team 1, report!" A grainy crackle of static. Then a voice, not Rand's. "Secure. Where's Rand?" A pause, followed by laughter. "You'll have to give him a minute. That woman sure packs a wallop." It had been too easy. Michael had expected more of a fight. Any kind of fight. "These guns are practically empty," Greer showed him. None of the soldiers' magazines had more than 2 rounds. "What about the armory?" "Clean as a whistle." "That's actually not so good." From Greer, a tight nod. "I know. We'll have to do something about that." It was Rand who brought Lore to him. Her wrists were bound. At the sight of him, she startled, then quickly composed herself. "I guess you missed me, Michael?" "Hello, Lore." Then to Rand. "Take those off." Rand cut her loose. Lore had nailed him with a hard right cross. His left eye was half shut, his cheek marked with the imprint of her fist. Michael felt almost proud. "Let's go someplace and talk," he said. He led Lore into the station chief's office. Her office. For 15 years, the refinery had been Lore's to run. Michael sat behind the desk to make a point. Lore sat across from him. The day had broken, warming the room with its light. She looked older, of course, aged by sun and work, but the raw physicality was still there, the strength. "So how's your pal Dunk?" Michael smiled at her. "It's good to see you. You haven't changed a bit." "Are you trying to be funny?" "I mean it." She glanced away, a furious look on her face. "Michael, what do you want?" "I need fuel. Heavy diesel, the dirty stuff." "Going into the oil business? It's a hard life. I don't recommend it." He took a long breath. "I know this doesn't make you happy, but there's a reason." "Is that right?" "How much do you have?" "You know what I always liked best about you, Michael?"
"No, what?"
"I don't remember either."
It was true. She was just the same. Michael felt the frisson of attraction. Her power had not abated. He leaned back in his chair, balanced the tips of his fingers together, and said, "You have a major delivery to the Kerrville Depot scheduled in 5 days. Add that to what's in the storage tanks. I'm figuring you've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 gallons. Lore shrugged indifferently. So I should take that as a yes? You should take it up your ass, actually. I'm going to find out anyway. She sighed. Okay, fine. Yes, 80,000 more or less. Does that satisfy you? Good. I'm going to need it all. Laura cocked her head. I beg your pardon? With 20 tanker trunks, I'm thinking we can move it all in just under 6 days. After that, we'll release your people. No harm, no foul. You've got my word. Lore was staring at him.
Move it where? What the hell do you need 80,000 gallons for?
Ah. The tanker trucks were being loaded. The first convoy would be ready to move by 0900. For Michael, 5 days of looking at his watch, yelling at everyone, hurry the hell up. One wrinkle. Maybe small, maybe not. When Weir's men had stormed the communications hut, the radio operator had been in the midst of sending a message. There was no way to know what it was, because the man was dead. The morning's only fatality. How the hell did that happen? Weir shrugged. Lombardi thought he had a weapon. It looked like he was drawing on us. The weapon was a stapler. Have any messages come in since? Michael asked, thinking, Lombardi, of course it would be you, you trigger-happy asshole. Nothing so far. Michael cursed himself. The man's death was regrettable, but that wasn't the true source of his anger. They should have taken out the radio first. A stupid mistake. Probably not the first. Get on the horn, he said, then thought the better of it. No, wait until 1200. That's when they expect the refinery to check in. What should I tell them? Sorry, we shot the radio operator. He was waving office supplies at us. Weir just looked at him. I don't know. Something normal. Everything's peachy. How are you? Isn't it a nice day? The man hurried away. Michael walked to the Humvee, where Lore was waiting in the back seat. Rand was handcuffing her to the safety rail.
You should take somebody else with you, Rand said.
Michael accepted the key to the cuffs and got in the cab. He glanced at Lore through the mirror. You promise to be good, or do you need a babysitter?
The man you shot. His name was Cooley. The guy wouldn't squash a bug.
Michael looked at Rand. I'll be fine. Just get that diesel moving. The drive to the channel took 3 hours. Lore barely uttered a word, and Michael made no effort to draw her out. It had been a hard morning for her. The end of a career, the death of a friend, a public humiliation, all at the hands of a man she had every reason to despise. She needed time to adjust, especially considering the things Michael was about to tell her. They passed through the wires and made their way down the causeway. He brought the truck to a halt behind the machine shed at the edge of the quay. From here, the Bergensfjord wasn't visible. He wanted a grand unveiling.
So why am I here?
Michael opened Lore's door and unlocked her wrists. As she climbed out of the Humvee, he withdrew his sidearm and held it out to her.
What's this?
A gun, obviously.
And you're giving it to me?
You get to pick. Shoot me, take the truck, you'll be back in Kerrville by nightfall. Stay, and you'll know what this is all about. But there are rules. Lore said nothing, merely raised an eyebrow.
Rule one is you can't leave unless I allow it. You're not a prisoner. You're one of us. Once I tell you what's happening, you'll see the necessity.
Rule two is I'm in charge. Speak your mind, but never question me in front of my men. She was looking at him as if he'd lost all sense. Still, the offer had to be made. The woman had to choose.
Why in hell would I want to join you?
Because I'm going to show you something that will change everything you thought you knew about your life. And because, deep down, you trust me. She stared at him, then laughed. The comedy never stops, does it? I wasn't fair to you, Lore. I'm not proud of what I did. You deserved better than that. But there was a reason. I said you haven't changed, which is true. That's why I brought you here. I need your help. I can see why you'd say no. But I hope you won't. She eyed him suspiciously. Where exactly is Dunk? This was never about the trade. I needed money and manpower. More than that, I needed secrecy. 5 weeks ago, Dunk and all his lieutenants went into the channel. There is no trade anymore. Only me, and those loyal to me. He nudged the gun toward her. The mag is full and there's one in the pipe. What you do with it is up to you. Lore accepted the pistol. For a long moment she looked at it, until with a heavy sigh she slid it into the waistband of her jeans at the base of her spine. If it's all right with you, I'm keeping this. That's fine. It's yours now.
I must be out of my mind.
You made the right choice. I regret it already. I'm only going to say this one time. But you really broke my heart. You know that? I do. And I apologize. A brief silence. Then she nodded, just once. Case closed.
So?
Brace yourself. He wanted Lore to see the Bergensfjord from below. That was the best way. Not just to see her, but to experience her. Only then could her meaning be grasped. They took the stairs to the floor of the dry dock. Michael waited as Lore approached the hull. The ship's flanks were smooth and gracefully curved, every rivet tight. Beneath the Bergensfjord's massive propellers, Lore came to a halt, gazing upward. Michael would let her speak first. Above them, the clang of footfalls, men calling to one another, the whine of a pneumatic drill, the ship's vast square footage of metal amplifying every sound like a giant tuning fork.
I knew there was a boat.
Michael was standing beside her. She turned to face him. In her eyes, a struggle was being waged. She's called the Bergensfjord, Michael said. Lore spread her hands and looked around.
All this?
Yes.
For her.
Lore moved forward, extended her right hand over her head, and pressed it against the hull. Just as Michael had done on the morning they drained the water from the dock, revealing the Bergensfjord in all her rusted, invincible glory. Lore held it there, then, as if startled, broke away.
You're scaring me, she said.
I know.
Please tell me you were just keeping your hands busy. That I'm not seeing what I think I'm seeing.
What do you think you're seeing?
A lifeboat.
Some color had drained from her face. She seemed uncertain where to direct her eyes.
I'm afraid it is, Michael said. You're lying. You're making this up.
It's not good news.
I'm sorry.
How could you possibly know? There's a lot to explain. But it's going to happen. The virals are coming back, Lore. They were never really gone.
This is crazy.
Her confusion turned to anger.
You're crazy. Do you know what you're saying?
I'm afraid I do.
I don't want anything to do with this.
She was backing away.
This can't be true. Why don't people know? They would know, Michael.
That's because we haven't told them.
Who the hell is we?
Me and Greer. A handful of others. There's no other way to say this, so I just will. Anybody who's not on this boat is going to die. And we're running out of time. There's an island in the South Pacific. We believe it's safe there. maybe the only safe place. We have food and fuel for 700 passengers. Maybe a few more. He hadn't expected this to be easy. Under ideal circumstances, he would have softened the blow. But Lore would cope, because that was her nature. The meat and marrow of Lore de Vere. What had passed between them years ago was, for her, a painful memory, perhaps. A quick jolt of anger and regret that touched her from time to time. But not for Michael. She was part of his life, and a good part, because she was one of the few people who had ever understood him. There were people who simply made existence more bearable. Lore was one. "That's why I brought you here. We have a long voyage ahead of us. I need the diesel, but that's not all. The men who work for me, well, you've met them. They're hard workers, and they're loyal. But that only goes so far. I need you." Her struggle was not over. There was more talking to be done. Nevertheless, Michael saw his words taking hold. "Even if what you say is true," Lore said, "what can I possibly do?" The Bergensfjord. He had given her everything. Now, he would give her this. "I need you to learn how to drive her." 35. The funeral was held in the early morning, a simple gravesite service. Meredith had requested that no general announcement of Vicky's death be made until the following day. Despite her high profile, Vicky had been a guarded person, sharing her private life with just a handful of people. "Let it just be us." Peter offered a few words, followed by Sister Peg. The last to speak was Meredith. She appeared composed. She'd had years to prepare. "Still," she said, with a hitch in her voice, "one was never really ready." She then went on to tell a series of hilarious stories that left them all weeping with laughter. At the end, everyone was saying the same thing. Vicky would have been so pleased. They adjourned to the house that was now Meredith's alone. The bed in the parlor was gone. Peter moved among the mourners, government officials, military, a few friends. Then, as he was preparing to leave, Chase took him aside. "Peter, if you have a second, there's something I'd like to discuss with you." Here it comes, he thought. The timing made sense. Now that Vicky was gone, the man felt that the path had been cleared for him. They stepped into the kitchen. Chase appeared uncharacteristically anxious, fiddling with his beard. "This is a little awkward for me," he admitted. "You can stop right there, Ford. It's okay. I've decided not to run again." It surprised Peter a little, how easily the words had come. He felt a burden lifting. "I'll give you my full endorsement. You should have no problems." Chase looked perplexed, then laughed. "I'm afraid you've got it wrong. I want to resign." Peter was dumbstruck. "I was waiting until Vicky... well, I knew she'd be disappointed in me." "But I thought you always wanted it." Chase shrugged. "Oh, there was a time when I did. When she picked you, I was pretty sore. I won't deny it. But not anymore. We've had our differences along the way, but the woman was right. You were the man for the job." How could Peter have so badly misjudged? "I don't know what to say." "Say... good luck, Ford." He did just that. "What will you do?" "Olivia and I are thinking Bandera. It's good cattle land out there. The telegraphs are in. The town's first on the drawing board for the rail line. I figure 50 years from now, I'll make my grandkids rich." Peter nodded. "It's a sound plan." "You know, If you're really not running again, I'd be willing to talk about a partnership.
You're serious?
It was actually Olivia's idea. The woman knows me. I'm all about the details. You want to fix the sewers on time, I'm your guy. But a cattle operation takes more than that. It takes nerve, and it takes capital. Just your name on the operation will open a lot of doors.
I really don't know anything about cows, Ford.
And I do?
We'll learn.
That's what everybody's doing these days, isn't it?
We'd be a good team. We have so far.
Peter had to admit it. The notion was intriguing. Somehow, through the years, he had failed to notice that he and Chase had become, of all things, friends.
But who's going to run if you don't?
Does it matter?
We're half a government now. Another 10 years, this place will be empty, a relic. People will be making their own ways. My guess is, the next guy to sit in that chair will be the one to turn the lights off. Personally, I'm glad it won't be you. I'm your advisor. So let this be my last piece of advice. Go out strong. Get rich. Leave a fortune behind. Have a life, Peter. You've earned it. The rest will take care of itself. Peter couldn't argue the point.
How soon do you need my answer?
I'm not Vicky. Take time to think it over. It's a big step, I know that.
Thank you, Peter said.
What for?
All of it.
From Chase, a grin.
You're welcome.
The letter's on your desk, by the way. After Chase had gone, Peter lingered in the kitchen. He emerged a few minutes later to find that nearly everyone had left. He said goodbye to Meredith and stepped onto the porch, where Apgar was waiting with his hands in his pockets.
Chase bowed out.
An eyebrow went up.
Did he now?
You wouldn't by any chance feel like running for president.
Ha! Huh.
A young officer jogged up the path. He was out of breath and sweating hard, evidently having run a great distance.
What is it, son? Peter said.
Sirs, he said between gulps of air. You need to see something.
The truck was parked in front of the Capitol. Four soldiers were standing guard. Peter unlatched the tailgate and drew the canvas aside. Military crates filled the space, packed to the ceiling. Two of the soldiers extricated a crate from the first row and lowered it to the ground.
I haven't seen one of these in years, Apgar said.
The crates had come from Dunk's bunker. Inside, vacuum-sealed in plastic strips, lay ammunition. 223, 556, 9mm, 45 ACP. Apgar broke the seal on a round, held it up to the light, and whistled admiringly.
This is the good stuff.
Original army. He rose and turned to one of the soldiers.
Corporal, how many rounds do you have in your sidearm?
One and one, sir.
Give it here.
The soldier handed it over. Apgar dropped the magazine, cleared the chamber, and topped the magazine off with a fresh cartridge. He racked the slide and held out the gun to Peter.
You want the honors?
Be my guest.
Apgar aimed the pistol at a square of earth 10 feet away and pulled the trigger. There was a satisfying boom as dirt leapt up.
Let's see what else we've got, Peter said.
They removed a second crate. This one contained a dozen M16s with extra 30-round magazines, similarly sealed, looking fresh as the day they were made.
Did anybody see the driver? Peter asked.
Nobody had. The truck had simply appeared.
So why would Dunk be sending us this? Apgar asked.
Unless you brokered some kind of deal you didn't tell me about.
Peter shrugged.
I didn't.
Then how do you explain it?
Peter couldn't.
36. She crossed into Texas on Old Highway 20, the morning of the 43rd day,
Alicia had traveled half the breadth of a continent. The going had been slow at the start, cutting her way through the detritus of the coast, working inland across the rocky folds of the Appalachians. Then the way had loosened, and she'd begun to make good time. The days grew warmer, the trees burst into flower, springtime spread over the land. Whole days passed in heavy rain. Then the sun exploded over the earth. Unbelievable nights, wide and starlit, the moon rolling through its cycle as she rode. But now they stopped to rest. In the shade of a gas station awning, Alicia lay on the ground while Soldier grazed nearby. Just a few hours, and they'd press on. Her bones grew heavy. She felt herself plummeting into sleep. Throughout her journey, this had been the pattern. Days of wakefulness, her mind so alert it was almost painful. Then she'd fall like a bird shot from the sky. She dreamed of a city. Not New York. It was no city she had ever seen or known. The vision was majestic. In the darkness, it floated like an isle of light. Mighty ramparts surrounded it, protecting it from all danger. From within came noises of life. Voices, laughter, music, the delighted shrieks of children at play. The sounds fell upon her like a shimmering rain. How Alicia longed to be among the inhabitants of that happy city. She made her way toward it and walked its perimeter, searching for a way in. There seemed to be none, but then she found a door. It was tiny, fit for a child. She knelt and turned the handle, but the door wouldn't budge. She became aware that the voices had faded. Above her, the city wall soared into blackness. "Let me in!" She began to pound the door with her fists. Panic was consuming her. "Somebody, please! I'm all alone out here!" Still, the door refused her. Her cries became howls. And then she saw. There was no door. The wall was perfectly smooth.
"Don't leave me!"
On the far side, the city had fallen silent. The people, the children, all gone. She pounded till she could pound no more and collapsed to the ground, sobbing into her hands.
"Why did you leave me? Why did you leave me?"
She awoke in twilight. Lying motionless, she blinked the dream away, then rose on her elbows to see Soldier standing at the edge of the shelter. He angled one dark eye at her. "All right already. I'm coming." Kerrville was 4 days away. 37. Kate and the girls had been with them a little more than a month. At the start, Caleb hadn't minded. It was good for Pim to have family around, and the girls adored Theo. But as the weeks passed, Kate's mood only seemed to darken. It filled the house like a gas. She did few chores and spent long hours sleeping, or else sitting on the front steps, staring into space. How long is she going to mope around like that? Pim was cleaning up the breakfast dishes. She dried her hands on a towel and looked at him squarely. "She's my sister. She just lost her husband." "She's better off," Caleb thought, but didn't say so. He didn't have to. "Give her time, Caleb." Caleb left the house. In the dooryard, Elle and Bug were playing with Theo, who had learned to crawl. The boy was capable of astonishing speed. Caleb reminded the girls to keep an eye on their cousin and not wander far from the house. He was hitching the horses to the plow when he heard a cry of shock and pain. He dashed back to the yard as Kate and Pim came running from the house.
"Get them off! Get them off!"
Elle's bare legs were swarming with ants. Hundreds of them. Caleb scooped her up and ran to the trough, the little girl writhing and shrieking in his arms. He plunged her into the water and began frantically stripping the ants from her legs, running his hands up and down her skin. The ants were on him, too. He felt the electrical sting of their teeth boring into his arms, his hands, inside the collar of his shirt. At last, Elle quieted, her screams yielding to hiccupy sobs. A dark scrim of ant corpses had floated to the surface of the trough. Caleb lifted her out and handed her to Kate, who wrapped her in a towel. Her legs were covered with welts. "There's ointment inside," Pym signed. Kate carried Elle away. Caleb drew his shirt over his head and shook it out, sending ants scattering. He had plenty of bites, too, but nothing like his niece. "Where are Theo and Bug?" he asked. "In the house." It had been a hard spring for ants. People were saying it was the weather. The wet winter, the dry spring, the early summer, shockingly warm. The woods were bursting with their mounds, some reaching gigantic proportions. Pym gave him a look of concern. "Is there anything we can do?" "This can't last forever. We should keep the kids inside until it passes." But it didn't pass. The next morning, the ground around the house was swarming. Caleb decided to burn the mounds. From the shed, he retrieved a can of fuel and carried it to the edge of the woods. He chose the largest pile, a yard wide and half as high, splashed it with kerosene, tossed a match, and stepped back to watch. As black smoke roiled upward, ants exploded from the mound in a massive horde. Simultaneously, the hardened earth of the mound's surface began to bulge volcanically, then split open like a piece of rotten fruit. Soil cascaded down the sides. Caleb lurched back. What the hell was down there? It must have been a gigantic colony, millions of the little bastards, driven to mad panic by the smoke and flames. The mound collapsed. Caleb stepped gingerly forward. The last of the flames were sputtering out. All that remained was a shallow indentation in the earth. Pym came up beside him. "What happened?" "Not sure." From where he stood, he counted five other mounds. "I'm taking the wagon. Stay inside." "Where are you going?" Pym signed. "I need to get more gas." 38. The possum man was missing. The possum man, but also dogs. Lots of dogs. The city was usually crawling with them, especially in the flatland. You couldn't walk 10 paces down there without seeing one of the damn things, all skinny legs and matted fur and gooey eyes, snuffling through a garbage pile or crouched to take a wormy shit in the mud. But suddenly, no dogs. The possum man lived on the river near the old perimeter. He looked like what he did, pale and pointy-nosed, with dark, slightly bulging eyes and ears that stuck out from the sides of his face. He kept a woman half his age, though not the sort that anyone would want. According to her, they'd heard noise in the yard late at night. They figured it might be foxes, which had gotten into the hutches before. The possum man had grabbed his rifle and gone out to look. One shot, then nothing. Eustace was kneeling by what was left of the hutches, which looked like they'd been hit by a tornado. If there were tracks, Eustace couldn't find any. The earth in the yard was packed too hard. Possum corpses were strewn around, torn to bloody chunks, although a few yards away a pair of them fidgeted in the dirt, staring at him woefully like traumatized witnesses. They were actually kind of cute. As the closest one loped toward him, Eustace extended his hand. "Don't want to do that," the woman warned. "They're nasty fuckers. Bite your finger off." Eustace yanked his hand away. "Right." He stood and looked at the woman. Her name was Rena, Renee, something like that, as scraggly-looking a thing as he'd ever laid eyes on. It was entirely possible that her parents had given her to the possum man in exchange for food. Such bargains were common. "You said you found the rifle." She retrieved it from the house. Eustace worked the bolt, kicking out an empty cartridge. He asked her where she'd found it. Her eyes didn't look in quite the same direction. It made her a little hard to talk to. "Just about where you're standing." "And you didn't hear anything else? Only the one shot?"
"Happened like I said."
He was beginning to wonder if maybe she'd done it. Shot the possum man, dragged his body to the river, busted up the hutches to cover her tracks. Well, If she had, she probably had a good enough reason, and Eustace sure as hell wasn't going to do anything about it. I'll put the word out. He turns up, you let us know.
You sure you don't want to come inside, Sheriff?
She was giving him a look. It took Eustace a second to figure out what it was. Her off-kilter gaze traveled the length of his body, then lingered pointedly. The gesture was supposed to be seductive, but was more like livestock trying to sell itself.
Folks say you ain't got a woman.
Eustace wasn't perturbed. Well, maybe a little. But the woman had been treated like property all her life. She had no other way of doing things. Don't believe everything you hear.
But what'll I do? He's dead.
You've got 2 possums, don't you? Make more.
Them there? Them's both boys.
Eustace handed back the rifle. I'm sure you'll think of something. He returned to the jail. Fry, at his desk with his boots up, was paging through a picture book. She'd try to poke you? Fry asked, not looking up. Eustace sat behind his desk. How do you know?
They say she does that.
He turned to Paige.
Think she killed him?
She might've. Eustace gestured at the book. What you got there? Fry held it up to show him. Where the wild things are.
That's a good one, Eustace said.
The door swung open and a man entered, banging dust from his hat. Eustace recognized him. He and his wife farmed a patch of ground on the other side of the river.
Sheriff? Deputy?
He nodded at each of them in turn.
Help you, Bart?
He cleared his throat nervously.
It's my wife.
I can't find her anywhere. It was 9 a.m. By noon, Eustace had heard the same story 14 times. 39. It was mid-afternoon by the time Caleb reached town on the buckboard. The place seemed totally dead. No people anywhere. In 2 hours on the road, he hadn't seen a single soul. The door of the mercantile was locked. Caleb cupped his eyes to the glass. Nothing. No movement inside. He stilled his body, listening to the quiet. Where the hell was everybody? Why would George close up in the middle of the day? He walked around to the alley. The back door stood ajar. The frame was splintered. The door had been forced. He returned to the buckboard for his rifle. He nudged the door open with the tip of the barrel and moved inside. He was in the storeroom. The space was tightly packed, sacks of feed piled high, coils of fencing, spools of chain and rope, leaving only a narrow corridor through which to pass.
George, he called. George, are you in here?
He felt and heard crunching underfoot. One of the bags of feed had been torn open. As he knelt to look, he heard a high-pitched clicking above his head. He lurched back, swinging the barrel of the rifle upward. It was a raccoon. The animal was sitting on top of the pile. It lifted onto its hind legs, rubbing its 2 front paws together, and gave him a look of absolute innocence.
That mess on the floor? Nothing to do with me, pal.
Go on, beat it.
Caleb poked the barrel of the rifle forward.
Get your ass out of here before I make you into a hat.
The raccoon scampered down the pile and out the door. Caleb took a breath to calm his heart and passed through the beaded curtain into the store. The lockbox where George kept the day's receipts sat beneath the counter in its usual spot. He moved through the aisles, finding nothing amiss. A flight of stairs behind the counter led to the second floor, presumably George's living quarters.
George, if you're there, it's Caleb Jackson. I'm coming up.
He found himself in a single large room with upholstered furniture and curtains on the windows. The hominess of it surprised him. He had expected a scene of bachelor squalor. But George had been married once. The room was divided into 2 areas, one for living, the other for sleeping. A kitchen table, a couch and chairs with lace doilies on the headrests, a cast iron bed with a sagging mattress, an ornately carved wardrobe of a type that usually stayed within a family, traveling the road of several generations. All seemed orderly enough, but as Caleb surveyed the space, he began to notice certain things. A dining chair had been knocked over, books and other objects, a kitchen pot, a ball of yarn, a lantern, were tossed about the floor. A large freestanding mirror had shattered in its frame, the glass cracked in concentric circles, like a reflective spider's web. As he moved toward the bed, the odor hit him, the rancid, biological reek of old vomitus. George's chamber pot sat on the floor near the headboard. That was where the smell was coming from. Blankets were bunched at the foot of the mattress as if kicked aside by a restless sleeper. On the bedside table lay George's gun, a long-barreled .357 revolver. Caleb opened the cylinder and pushed the ejection rod. 6 cartridges fell into his palm. 1 had been fired. He turned around and swept the pistol over the room, then lowered the gun and stepped toward the fractured mirror. At the epicenter of the cracks was a single bullet hole. Something had happened here. George had obviously been ill, but there was more to it. A robbery? But the lockbox hadn't been touched. And the bullet hole was strange. A stray shot, perhaps, though something about it seemed deliberate. As if, lying in bed, George had shot his own reflection. In the alley, he filled his jugs from the tank and loaded them onto the buckboard. It wouldn't do to leave without paying. He made his best guess and left the bills under the counter with a note. Nobody here. Door unlocked. Took 15 gallons of kerosene. If the money isn't enough, I'll be back in a week and can pay you then. Sincerely, Caleb Jackson. On the way out of town, he stopped at the town office to report what he'd found. At least someone should fix the door of the mercantile and lock the place up until they knew what had happened to George. But nobody was there, either. Dusk was settling down when he returned to the house. He unloaded the kerosene, put the horses in the paddock, and entered the house. Pim was sitting with Kate by the cold wood stove, writing in her journal. "Did you get what you needed?" He nodded. Strange how Kate was now the silent one. The woman had barely glanced up from her knitting. "How was town?" Caleb hesitated, then signed, "Very quiet." They ate corn cakes for supper, played a few hands of go-to, and went to bed. Pim was out like a light, but Caleb slept badly. He barely slept at all. All night his mind seemed to skip over the surface of sleep like a stone upon water, never quite breaking the skin. As dawn approached, he gave up trying and crept from the house. The ground was moist with dew, the last stars receding into a slowly paling sky. Birds were singing everywhere, but this wouldn't last. To the south, where the weather came from, a wall of flickering clouds roiled at the horizon. So, a spring storm. Caleb guessed he had maybe 20 minutes before it arrived. He gave himself another minute to watch it, then retrieved the first jug of kerosene from the shed and lugged it to the edge of the woods. He didn't know what he was seeing. It simply made no sense. Perhaps it was the light. But no. The mounds were gone. 40. 0600 hours. Michael Fisher, boss of the trade, stood on the quay to watch the morning light come on. A thick, cloudy dawn. The waters of the channel, caught between tides, were absolutely motionless. How long since he'd slept? He was not so much tired, he was well past that, as running on some reserve of energy that felt vaguely lethal, as if he were burning himself up. Once it was gone, that would be the end of him. He would vanish in a puff of smoke. He'd emerged from the bowels of the Bergensfjord with some vague intention he couldn't recall. The moment he'd hit fresh air, the plan had fled from his mind. He'd drifted down to the edge of the wharf and found himself just standing there. 21 years. Amazing how so much time could slip by. Events grabbed hold of you, and in the blink of an eye, there you were, with sore knees and a sour stomach, and a face in the mirror you barely recognized, wondering how all of it had happened. If that was really your life. The Bergensfjord was nearly ready. Propulsion, hydraulics, navigation, electronics, stabilizers, helm. The stores were loaded, the desalinators up and running. They'd stripped the ship to the simplest configuration. The Bergensfjord was basically a floating gas tank. But a lot had been left to chance. For instance, would she actually float? Computations on paper were one thing. Reality was another. And if she did, could her hull, cobbled together from 1,000 different plates of salvaged steel, 1,000,000 screws and rivets and patch welds, withstand a journey of such duration? Did they have enough fuel? What about the weather, especially when they attempted to round Cape Horn? Michael had read everything he could find about the waters he intended to cross. The news was not good. Legendary storms, cross currents of such violence that they could snap your rudder off, waves of towering dimensions that could downflood you in a second. He sensed someone coming up behind him. Lore. Nice morning, she said. Looks like rain. She shrugged, looking over the water. Still nice, though. She meant, how many more mornings will we have? How many dawns to watch? Let's enjoy it while we can. How are things in the pilot house? Michael asked. She blew out a breath. Don't worry, he said. You'll get it. A bit of pink was in the clouds now. Gulls swooped low over the water. It really was a fine morning, Michael thought. He felt suddenly proud. Proud of his ship, his Bergensfjord. She had traveled halfway around the world to test his worthiness. She had given them a chance and said, "Take it if you can." A glow of light appeared on the causeway. There's Greer, he said. I better go. Michael made his way up the quay and met the first tanker truck just as Greer stepped down from the cab. That's the last of it, Greer said. We tapped out at 19 tankers, so we left the last one behind. Any problems? A patrol eyeballed us south of the barracks at Rosenberg. I guess they just assumed we were on the way to Kerrville. I thought they'd be onto us by now, but apparently they're not. Michael glanced over Greer's shoulder and signaled to Rand. You got this one? Men were swarming over the tankers. Rand gave him a thumbs up. Michael looked at Greer again. The man was obviously worn out. His face had thinned to skull-like proportions, cheekbones ridged like knives, eyes red-rimmed and sunk into their pockets, skin waxy and damp. A frost of white stubble covered his cheeks and throat. His breath was sour. Let's get something to eat, Michael said. I could go for some shut-eye. Have breakfast with me first. They'd erected a tent on the quay with a commissary and cots for resting. Michael and Greer filled their bowls with watery porridge and sat at a table. A few other men were hunched over their breakfasts, robotically shoveling the gruel into their mouths, faces slack with exhaustion. Nobody was talking. Everything else good to go? Greer asked. Michael shrugged. More or less. When do you want us to flood the dock? Michael took a spoon of the porridge. She should be ready in a day or two. Lore wants to inspect the hull herself. Careful woman, our Lore. Patch appeared on the far side of the tent. Eyes unfocused, he shambled across the space, lifted the lid on the pot, decided against it, and took one of the cots instead. Not so much lying down as succumbing, like a man felled by a bullet. You should catch a few winks yourself, Greer said. Michael gave a painful laugh. Wouldn't that be nice? They finished breakfast and walked to the loading area, where Michael's pickup was parked. Two of the tankers were already drained and standing off to the side. An idea took shape in Michael's mind. Let's leave one tanker full and move it to the end of the causeway. Do we have any of those sulfur igniters left?
We should.
No further explanation was necessary. I'll let you see to it. Michael got in the pickup and placed his Beretta in the bracket under the steering wheel. A short-barreled shotgun with a pistol grip and a side saddle of extra shells was clamped between the seats. His rucksack rested on the passenger seat. More rounds, a change of clothes, matches, a first aid kit, a pry bar, a bottle of ether and a rag, and a cardboard folder sealed with twine. Michael started the engine. You know, I've never been in jail before. What's it like? Greer grinned through the open window. The food's better than it is here. The naps are sensational. So, something to look forward to. Greer's expression sobered. He can't know about her, Michael. Or about Carter. You're not making my job any easier, you know. It's how she wants it. Michael regarded his friend for another few seconds. The man really did look terrible. Go sleep, he said. I'll add it to my to-do list. The two men shook. Michael put the truck in gear. 41. Everybody settle down. The auditorium was packed, all the seats taken, with more people crowded into the back and along the aisles. The room stank of fear and unwashed skin. At the front of the room, the mayor, red-faced and sweating, pointlessly banged his gavel on the podium, yelling for silence, while behind him, the members of the Free State Council, as ineffective a group of individuals as Eustace had ever laid eyes on, found papers to shuffle and buttons to adjust, guiltily averting their gazes like a group of students caught cheating on a test.
My wife's missing. My husband. Has anybody seen him? My kids. Two of them. What happened to all the dogs? Did anybody else notice that? No dogs anywhere.
More banging of the gavel.
God damn it, people, please.
And so on. Eustace glanced at Fry, who was standing on the other side of the room and sending him a look that said, oh boy, ain't this going to be fun. Finally, the room quieted enough for the mayor to be heard.
Okay, that's better. We know everybody's worried and wants answers. I'm going to bring up the sheriff who can maybe shed some light. Gordon?
Eustace took the podium and got to it.
Well, we don't know much more at this point than everybody else. About 70 folks have gone missing over the last couple of nights. Mind, these are the ones we know about. Deputy Fry and I haven't gotten out to all the farms yet.
So why aren't you out looking for them?
A voice yelled. Eustace parsed the man's face from the crowd.
Because I'm standing here talking to you, Gar. Now just button it so I can get through this.
A voice barked from the other side of the room.
Yeah, shut your mouth and let the man talk.
More yelling, anxious voices volleying back and forth. Eustace let it run its course.
Like I was saying, he continued, we don't know where these folks have gone off to. What seemed to have happened is that, for whatever reason, these individuals got up in the middle of the night, went outside, and didn't come back.
Maybe somebody's taken them, Gar yelled. Maybe that person is right here in this room.
The effect was instantaneous. Everybody started looking at everybody else. A low murmuring rippled through the room.
Could it be? We're not ruling anything out at this point, Eustace said, aware of how weak this sounded. But that doesn't seem so likely. We're talking about a lot of people.
Maybe it's more than one person doing this.
Gar, you want to come up here and run this meeting?
I'm just saying
what you're doing is scaring people. I'm not having you start a panic, people looking sideways at each other. For all we know, these folks have gone off on their own. Now pipe down before I lock you up.
A woman in the front row rose to her feet.
Are you saying my boys ran away? They're 6 and 7.
No, I'm not saying that, Lena. We just don't have any more information than what I'm telling you. The best thing people can do is stay in their homes till we sort this out.
And what about my wife?
Eustace couldn't see who was talking. Are you saying she just up and left me? The mayor, stepping forward to retake the podium, held up both hands. I think what the sheriff is trying to express...
He's not expressing anything. You heard him. He doesn't know.
Everybody started shouting again. There was no taking this thing back. It was spiraling out of control. Eustace glanced across the stage at Fry, who tipped his head toward the wings. As the mayor resumed banging his gavel, Eustace slipped backstage and met Fry at the door. The two men stepped outside.
Well, that was sure productive, Fry said. Glad to get out before the shooting started. I wouldn't joke about that. We're going to be on the top of everybody's list if we don't figure this thing out.
Think they're still alive?
Not really.
What do you want to do?
The day was bright and warm, the sun midpoint in a cloudless sky. Eustace remembered a day like this one. Spring on the cusp of summer, the earth unclenching its fist, thick green leaves, rich with fragrance, fattening the trees. A walk by the river, Simon balanced on his shoulders, Nina beside him. The day like a marvelous gift, and then the moment, unmistakable, when the boy had had his fill. Returning to the house and putting him down for his nap, Nina beckoning to him from the doorway with her special smile, the one only for him, and the two of them tiptoeing to their room to make quiet, lazy love on a sunny afternoon. Always the joke. How can you kiss this damn ugly face of mine? But she could. She did. The last such day. For Eustace, there would never come another. Let's find those missing people. 42. Apgar found Peter where he always was, at his desk, wading through a mass of paperwork. Just 2 days without Chase's organizing presence, and Peter felt completely swamped.
Got a minute?
Make it fast.
Apgar took the chair across from him. Chase really sandbagged you. You shouldn't have let him off the hook so easily.
What can I say? I'm too nice.
Apgar cleared his throat.
We've got a problem.
He was filling out a form. Are you quitting too?
Probably not the moment for that. I got a message from Rosenberg this morning. A lot of tankers moving through there in the last few days, but none of it is showing up here.
Peter raised his head.
You heard me.
What does the refinery say?
Everything on schedule, blah, blah, blah.
Then, as of this morning, not a peep, and we can't raise them. Peter leaned back in his chair.
Good God.
I've got men on the way to the refinery to check it out, Apgar continued. But I think I know what we'll find. You've got to hand it to the guy for balls anyway.
What the hell would Dunk need our oil for?
My bet is he doesn't. It's a play. He wants something.
Such as?
You've got me there. It isn't going to be small, though. Light and Power says we have enough gas on hand for 10 days. A few more if we ration. Even if we can secure the refinery, no way we can get enough slick back into the system to keep the lights burning. In less than 2 weeks, this city goes dark.
Dunk had them in a vice.
Peter had to admit, begrudgingly, that it was sort of brilliant. But one piece didn't fit.
So he sends us a truck full of guns and ammo, then hijacks all our oil?
It seems contradictory.
Maybe the guns came from somebody else.
That was bunker ammo. Only the trade has that stuff.
Apgar shifted in his chair.
Well, here's another piece to consider. First, you've got Cousin's place going up in smoke. Then there's a rumor going around that one of Dunk's women showed up in the city saying that something happened out there.
A lot of shooting.
A power play by one of his guys, you mean? Could be just gossip. And I don't see how it fits, but it's something to consider. Where is she now?